From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Friday, the president decided he had some splaining to do. Like why, after September 11th, U.S. intelligence began to supersize.
We were shaken by the signs we had missed leading up to the attacks. How the hijackers had made phone calls to known extremists and traveled to suspicious places. So we demanded that our intelligence community improve its capabilities.
And they did, he said. Our expanding ability to penetrate digital communications has enabled us to track and unravel terrorist plots and repel cyber attacks on our government, our banks, and our grids. But he also said that he, like the rest of us, found all the data mining, including our data, quote, disquieting. So when he became president, he ordered a review of those programs.
And nothing that I've learned since indicated that our intelligence community has sought to violate the law or is cavalier about the civil liberties of their fellow citizens.
Nevertheless, he said he gets it.
It is not enough for leaders to say, trust us, we won't abuse the data we collect. For history has too many examples when that trust has been breached.
We need safeguards, he said. So, with regard to the NSA's bulk collection of telephone records, he agreed with an outside panel that the NSA no longer hold that information. It should stay with the telecommunications companies or a third party. But, he said, the NSA still must be able to access and analyze it. That's a difficult needle to thread. Likewise, the president will end the lifelong gag order on national security letters, which secretly request information, but he rejected his panel's recommendation that national security letters be issued only with a court order. He'll increase some oversight of the FISA court, but rebuffing the panel again, he will not put a public advocate inside. And we won't spy so much on Angela Merkel or other foreign heads of state. Though, you know, everyone does it.
It may seem sometimes that America is being held to a different standard. And I'll admit, the readiness of some to assume the worst motives by our government can be frustrating. No one expects China to have an open debate about their surveillance programs. Or Russia to take privacy concerns of citizens in other places into account.
That might be taken as a little dig at former NSA contractor and super leaker Edward Snowden, now holed up in Moscow, who once said that he sought refuge in Hong Kong because of its spirited commitment to free speech. His revelations about the NSA sparked the current debate.
Hi, and Merry Christmas.
Here's his Christmas message.
Recently, we learned that our governments, working in concert, have created a system of worldwide mass surveillance, watching everything we do.
He learned us, not just about the NSA's domestic surveillance, but its foreign spying. In fact, just this week, the New York Times reported on a secret technology that allows the NSA to alter computers from miles away, even if they aren't connected to the internet, an impressive weapon in our cyber arsenal. At least it was when it was secret. The Times had held that information since 2012 at the request of American intelligence agencies. But then it was published in Der Spiegel, gleaned from Snowden's documents, so the Times published too. How you feel about that probably determines how you feel about Snowden and about the need for intelligence gathering in general.
If any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy.
Nevertheless, the president was prompted to pull back, maybe even yield a little power of his own free will. Has any other president done that? Has any other president even conceded that it would be in the nation's interest to do so? Maybe Eisenhower, on another historic January 17th, back in 1961.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
That was Eisenhower's farewell address. The military-industrial complex ballooned. But this president still has time left to, as Bob said, thread that needle, if the Congress and the public really want him to. This week, a D.C. district court dealt what is likely a mortal blow to network neutrality. I know. How many times I gotta tell you, this matters. Net neutrality is the idea that every internet user should have the same quality of service, whether it's you or Google or Netflix. The court went against the FCC, which sought to ensure that companies like Comcast and Verizon would not force certain websites to pay for better service or block certain websites because they were competitors. But because back in 2002, the FCC had classified internet service providers as information services and not common carriers, it lost its case this week. Now ISPs can do whatever they want and charge whatever they want. Netflix is probably going to have to pay more, so you will too. In a minute, we'll consider the implications of that decision with Siva Vaidyanathan, but first, you may be wondering why you're hearing Peter and the Wolf. It's because this show has been covering the net neutrality battle long before most people cared. Actually, most people still don't, but they should. Anyway, sometimes the news was hard to explain, like back in 2010, when the internet world compromised with itself. It decided that ISPs would treat all websites the same if they were accessed from home computers, but they wouldn't get the same treatment, at the same price anyway, when accessed on a cell phone. It was a big deal, but complicated, so I tried something new. Here's a clip from that piece. In the symphonic saga, Peter and the Wolf, Sergei Prokofiev assigned themes to Peter, the bird, the duck, the cat, grandfather, and the wolf. But assigning the bad guy theme in our story is tricky. Everybody thinks they're the good guy. So, in the interest of fairness, we're not assigning the wolf's theme. In our rendering, the net neutrality advocate Siva Vaidyanathan, who teaches media studies at the University of Virginia, is the bird.
If we decide that the only level playing field will be that wire coming out of the wall into our personal computer, we might find that we've relegated all the freedom in the world to the 8-track tape deck over the next 20 years. And that could be a terrible mistake.
Do you remember that?
I do. That was a fun moment. Yeah.
And it was back then, after a compromise, so-called, that ISPs would treat all services equally if you were using your computer at home, but they could charge various rates if you were accessing the internet from your phone.
And it's really not so much about charging rates to you and me, the users. It's more about charging extortion rates or payola to the providers of the content. That's kind of the information ecosystem we're used to for the past 200 years. We had a brief moment the past 20 years when it seemed like we might actually create a level playing field where someone's expressions and ideas could win the day over a tremendous amount of capital. But in the absence of network neutrality, we're going to be reverting back to that system in which there really are going to be very few avenues for insurgents, and incumbents will dominate just about every outlet for expression.
I think it's worth noting, for anyone who may have missed it, that they haven't had network neutrality on their iPhones and on their Androids since 2010. Have they experienced a different kind of service that an ordinary user might notice?
Yeah, in the sense that Apple has, in a number of cases, denied access to certain companies providing apps on their phone. And while Apple has not wanted to raise the concerns of consumer advocates and civil libertarians by blocking access through the browser to certain services, the fact that Apple blocked a Google Voice app for a while is a clear indication that the phone is a different game. Anything you download from iTunes is favored by your iPhone as opposed to any content you download otherwise. In fact, downloading a video file into your iPad from any service but iTunes is very difficult and cumbersome. Does that have First Amendment implications? Not really. Does it have competition implications, most definitely.
Yes, and that was something that the judges themselves observed, that, for example, a broadband provider like Comcast might limit its subscribers' ability to access the New York Times website if it wanted to spike traffic to its own news website. It might degrade the quality of the connection to a search website like Bing if a competitor like Google paid for prioritized access. Now, in this case, we're just talking about the wire to the wall. But if most of us are mobile, then this has been going on anyway.
Here, I'm going to say something sort of blasphemous. Among net neutrality advocates, as you know, I am one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how much it matters in the long run. I really see the last 20 years of what we call the internet, this sort of joyous, radical, anarchistic information system, as a historical blip, as a short period of time between two much longer periods of time, one yet to come, through which oligarchy rules.
Oh, that's really cheerful. So what you're basically saying is back to unfair business as usual.
I look at the real decision makers in our information ecosystem, and I see four big companies today. I see Apple, I see Microsoft, I see Facebook, and I see Google. And I say, what do those companies want? They aren't necessarily in the business of mastering and monitoring and monetizing what comes over your desktop computer or even your mobile phone. They want to run the operating systems of your life. They see a time in the not too distant future where so many different articles in our lives will have data flow through them. And they want to be able to monitor and monetize that data flow. They want to be the operating systems of our cars, of our refrigerators, of our eyeglasses, of our clothes. It's all about the data flow. Those companies I just mentioned have, to greater or lesser degrees, Google especially, argued for network neutrality when the game was all about that wire coming out of your wall. When the game is no longer played on that field, and there's no reason to think it will be very much longer, then those companies don't have an interest in network neutrality. In fact, they have the opposite interest. They have an interest in controlling the flow to the best of their ability to keep you in-house using their services so that they can monitor all that data. So when I look at the likely outcomes over the next 10 years, especially the next 20 years, I see nothing that looks like what we have traditionally called the internet.
It just seems weird, Siva, hearing you say that the time of competition and equality is over now. Google will just control, literally, our view of the world through our Google glasses.
Oh, I can go farther than that. I don't even think we had that much radical freedom back in the day, not so long ago, for a couple of reasons. Early on in our web experience, like around 1999, 2000, we started gathering our attention through Google, and it really spiked around 2003, 2004, to the point where Google governs our web experience largely, not exclusively, and certainly not all the way around the world. But for the most part, what Google thinks is important becomes what we think is important. Now, Google never did that with a heavy hand, but it did it with enough subtlety that Google was able to convince us that this was the natural way. The fact is, if we want things that markets don't provide easily, if we care about network neutrality and the beautiful results that we've had from it, all this creativity, this openness, this free speech, if we want all that, we're not wise to settle for traditional cable broadband as the battlefield.
I honestly can't tell how you feel about this. Are you resigned?
I'm not optimistic that the people of the United States of America will rise up for network neutrality in any form. I am not willing to resign, though, because, you know, in a democratic republic, or at least some semblance of one, we have a responsibility to be open and straightforward about what could be and keep fighting for it. Let's just have a much more mature and realistic discussion about it rather than fluctuating between utopianism and deep cynicism. We really need to have a comprehensive discussion in this country over the regulatory framework that will guide our use of data over the next few decades, because it's not about the internet. The internet is just a word we use to describe a complex set of tools and platforms and this interconnection of networks. It's a word that's actually quite distracting. The thing we should be talking about is the ways in which data affect our lives and who gets to control the data, who gets to monitor, monetize it. And this combines all these big different areas of thought that are subjects of your show, things like copyright, things like privacy, things like government surveillance, things like freedom of speech, and network neutrality all become part of a general framework where we identify the values we're after in a democratic republic, and we try to guide companies and limit companies in what they do so that we can benefit from great innovation and at the same time not suffer the consequences of extravagance from these companies.
I'm putting you in a grant proposal. Siva, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Brooke. Thanks.
Siva Vaidyanathan is the chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia.
Coming up, rap lyrics on trial and twibel, libel for a new generation.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Lumosity.com, designed by neuroscientists to work out your brain in a fun and challenging way. Lumosity offers personalized training programs to challenge your memory, attention, or processing speed. Lumosity users can train from anywhere with a computer or from an iPhone or iPad using the Lumosity app. Visit Lumosity.com, click the Start Training button to start playing today, and select On the Media from the drop-down menu.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Almost before they're issued notebooks, reporters are tutored in the basics of libel, specifically how to ensure that any accusations or characterizations you publish are not defamatory and actionable. But now that everyone can publish, we're wondering, does the libel standard for a 1,000-word article also apply to a one-sentence tweet? In other words, if you say something defamatory on Twitter, can you be held accountable for twibel? The first Twitter libel case in the United States went on trial this week. The defendant, actress and recording artist Courtney Love, who'd already settled a twibel case in 2011. Ellen Angelotti is a lawyer and a member of the Poynter Institute's faculty. She says that the decision in this case could become the social media equivalent of the New York Times versus Sullivan, the landmark 1964 case that was the first to consider the constitutional implications of defamation. As for Courtney Love's current woes, they began with a tweet.
Courtney Love said in a tweet, "I was fucking devastated when Rhonda J. Holmes Esquire of San Diego was bought off by at Fair News Spears. Perhaps you can get a quote." So she was angry that her attorney would not represent her in a fraud case she wanted to bring against the people who were managing the estate of her late husband, Kurt Cobain, the frontman from Nirvana.
Libel law does consider context. What is Courtney Love's claim about the context of Twitter that would protect her here?
What Courtney was saying was, given the hyperbole and exaggeration associated with the internet, that her tweet should be considered in the context of the opinion. She used examples from anonymous celebrity blogger sites.
And sometimes a judge will dismiss a libel complaint summarily on exactly those grounds, but this made its way to court.
Yes, a Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Michael Johnson said, "We don't necessarily see the context of Twitter being the same as those of online message boards. And because there is this ambiguity," he gave it a chance to go to jury trial and let a jury and the judge decide what exactly the context of Twitter is in the context of defamation.
How do you even define what constitutes context in the Twitter sphere?
That's a big challenge for a couple different reasons. First of all, when information is published on a newspaper or a radio broadcast, it goes through an editorial process. And the assumption in the past has been it is part of the public interest or it is a public controversy. On Twitter, because anyone's a publisher, that issue of is this a public concern or a public controversy is more difficult to apply. Also, you do have more clear-cut sections of a newspaper. When you see an article is in the opinion section, you assume that this is going to be an opinion piece rather than if you see an article in the news section. On Twitter, you don't have that.
Now, we've often talked about the self-correcting aspect of the internet. When you have a mistake in a blog post, someone can point it out, you can fix it. I guess Courtney Love could argue that Twitter offers fair hearing to anybody, no matter what you say about her.
This does speak to possibly why we haven't seen litigation in Twibel before. Is litigation really going to be the best remedy if somebody says something about you on Twitter that is false and harms your reputation? Are we going to adapt the law to give leeway to Twitter users, or are we going to apply traditional defamation law to the context of Twitter?
This is the first Twibel case to go to trial in the United States, but not around the world. There have been decisions in Australia and England. Considering the different bodies of libel law in those countries, do those decisions offer any precedent?
The first British Twibel case to go to trial was back in 2009, and it involved a British mayor. His rival took to Twitter and started saying what the British High Court found to be defamatory content. So in that case, the person whose reputation had been damaged, they were able to be compensated for that harm to their reputation.
One of the legacies of the New York Times versus Sullivan was that it set a pretty high bar for a finding of libel, especially when public figures are concerned. A lower bar applies to other kinds of defamation. I'm wondering whether this lawyer might have had a better case to sue for pure defamation or even slander, although Courtney Love's words were not actually spoken aloud.
The law around defamation is very ambiguous in the context of social media. We're seeing all of these people say horrible things about one another online, treating Twitter like the Wild Wild West because the courts don't understand the technology well enough to regulate it, and they also don't necessarily want to chill speech because of the First Amendment. Is it going to be an opportunity to apply traditional defamation law to the context of Twitter? Or is this going to be a case that reestablishes that balance of First Amendment rights and protection of the reputation? What we're investigating here is the reason I went to law school. Over Christmas break, I was sitting with my family, and I hear that Courtney Love's case is going to trial, and that was the best Christmas present I could have asked for.
Let me see if I've got this right, Ellen. A California lawyer has been accused of bribery. Courtney Love could be sued into oblivion, and you're going, woohoo!
And my family was looking at me like, wow, you need to get a life.
Ellen, thank you so much.
No problem.
Ellen Angelotti is a lawyer and a member of the faculty of the Poynter Institute.
This coming week, the Supreme Court of New Jersey will consider an appeal of a decision in 2008 that found Vontae Skinner guilty of attempted murder. On what evidence? Inconsistent eyewitness testimony and rap lyrics written by Skinner that spoke of violence and life on the street. The lyrics did not reference the victim or any details of the crime. In fact, they were composed before the shooting in question, but they were still the central piece of evidence that put him behind bars for a term of 30 years. Professor Charis Kubrin studies the surprisingly common use of rap lyrics as evidence and co-wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week called Rap Lyrics on Trial. Charis, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
I'm no lawyer, but I have seen many, many episodes of Law and Order, and it seems to me that this is the very definition of prejudicial testimony. How did a trial judge ever agree to allow this as evidence?
The character evidence argument, that's technically not the way in which they're allowed to introduce the evidence, but they're allowed to talk about the evidence as the defendant's knowledge, motive, or identity with respect to the crime. But the way it comes across to the jurors and everyone else involved is that this is sort of character evidence.
To the casual listener, I guess it's not an insane leap to imagine that a rap lyric may actually portray actual events, right?
Because that is correct.
Part
exactly.
And parcel of a rap artist's appeal is this whole notion of living the street life that usually he, is rapping about.
Correct.
But nobody thought Johnny Cash killed a man in Reno just to watch him die. And what may seem logical does not necessarily make it credible evidence.
people that listen to rap music generally know that a lot of this is marketing pose, that the very definition of gangster rap is to be over the top, explicit, violent, misogynistic. Unfortunately, people in the courtroom, including most jurors, themselves have no idea because they're not avid listeners or they don't necessarily appreciate the genre. Judges, prosecutors, others involved treat it as autobiographical confessions because the assumption is that what rap lyrics are is in fact these rhymed confessions.
I think the elephant in the room here is not only the legal question of what constitutes admissible evidence of state of mind, but race baiting. It sounds to me as if it's very easy to prey on the fears and the stereotypes in the minds of jurors by reading aloud some truly deplorable lyrics from a very violent rap song.
Absolutely. And Eric Nielsen and I, in our op-ed, discuss one study by Stuart Fishoff that shows how prejudicial and biased perceptions of rap music, in addition to who makes the music, and here we're talking about young, mostly minority men, right, from lower socioeconomic status, how all of that sort of combines to create perceptions that this individual is dangerous. And there's other research that has shown that when violent lyrics are identified as rap music compared to, say, country music, they're seen as more threatening and more problematic, and individuals are seen as more blameworthy and culpable than when it's attributed to another form of music.
How did you get into this particular subline of legal scholarship?
Well, I was contacted back in 2011 by a lawyer who had come across one of my studies that did a content analysis of gangster rap songs, asking if I would be interested in reviewing the facts of a case involving Olutosin Oduwale, who was an aspiring rapper that was being charged with making a terroristic threat. And basically what happened was in 2007, Oduwale's car ran out of gas, leading him to abandon it on the Edwardsville campus of Southern Illinois University, where he was a student. And when the school authorities found his car, among the many items they retrieved was this piece of paper that was crumpled and lodged between the seats. And on one side of the piece of paper were some scribbled rap lyrics, not surprising because he was an aspiring rapper, that everybody agreed were rap lyrics, including the state. And on the other side were some rap lyrics as well, followed by six lines of text at the bottom of the paper, which the state claimed represented a threat. And Tosin, which is his stage name, and his lawyers argued represented the beginning stages of a rap song.
These lines of text were not benign.
They were not benign.
It's not surprising that the police were alarmed. Can you tell me what they said?
Yes. The six lines of text read something along the lines of, send $2 to a PayPal account, and if this account doesn't reach $500,000, then a murderous rampage similar to the VT shooting will occur at another university, followed by, this is not a joke. And for obvious reasons, they did a search of the apartment, found more notebooks filled with lyrics than he was charged with making terroristic threats. So I was called in to review these notebooks and reviewed hundreds of pages of Oduwale's lyrics and came to the conclusion in the context of all of the evidence that there was a strong possibility that these were the beginnings of rap lyrics for a number of reasons. I explained that one of the very things we know about gangster rappers is they use this genre convention called an intro and an outro. And these are often non-rhyming words that set up the rap that's about to occur. And one of the things I discovered reviewing his lyrics is that Tosin liked to use intros and outros a lot in his raps. And so I argued that this may be an example of an intro or an outro, because one of the issues is, well, this doesn't rhyme, therefore it can't be a rap lyric.
What did the jury conclude? That Tosin was an aspiring rapper or that he was an aspiring extortionist and mass murderer?
They found him guilty.
Now, it is entirely possible that some of the criminal defendants on whose behalf you have testified really are bad actors, mm-hmm. and they really did do the crimes of which they were accused. But it's one thing to have done something and another thing to have it proven in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be clear here, you don't even want the actually guilty to be convicted based on irrelevant evidence.
Exactly. The point is, if these guys have done this, you need to find proper traditional evidence to prove that in a court. You cannot have highly prejudicial evidence, which is not central to the case, which is irrelevant to the case, as the defining factor of the case which leads this individual to be found guilty. And rap music, no matter how violent the imagery or how misogynistic the views expressed or how offensive you find it, is constitutionally protected speech, which has First Amendment protections and should not be used in courts.
Sharris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sharris E. Kubrin is an associate professor of criminology, law, and society at the University of California, Irvine.
In New York City, 30% of all shootings are tied to gang rivalries. There are over 300 street crews here, loosely affiliated gangs that battle mainly over turf, and their rivalries often play out over social media. In particular, they produce rap videos, and those videos are being used as evidence by New York City police to make arrests. Police arrested 11 crew members with the aid of a music video produced by the Dub Gang Money crew. Here's an example of one of their songs.
Get it or get out the way. I'm living like every day is a holiday. Dollar after dollar, I'm flying to Metropolitan. Your pockets is on a diet.
WNYC reporter Kathleen Horan reported for a year on the death of New York City kids by guns. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Let's talk about Xavier Granville, a 17-year-old shot and killed in Queens a year ago. His death seems to have been connected to a rivalry between his gang, the 40 Boys, also known as the Flamers, and another crew called The Flock. I'm going to play a little bit of a song posted on YouTube by Xavier's friend, DeAndre Kelly. You can hear him talking about a gun, his Glock, and name-checking the rival, Flock.
I'm gripping with my Glocks. 2012, crazy now, beef with the Flocks. Free Walker, taking can't stop her. Dude got a chopper.
Now let's hear a song from Flock, seemingly about Granville's murder.
Better take your last breath, yeah. They said, let's see your name coming. It's after breath, shit. And I ain't really want to do it, but I had to. Put myself in your shoes. This time I'd be mad.
I didn't really want to do it, but I had to, he said. Why is this useful information to the police?
In the Flamer video, Xavier appeared in that with all of his neighbors and friends who happened to be in his crew. And they're taunting the Flock. They're taunting the rival crew. That month, Xavier was shot. So that would tip off law enforcement that maybe they should look at it. These videos offer a window into things that are going on that most people in these communities wouldn't volunteer.
This stuff can't be used as anything other than circumstantial material, right?
It's part of an investigation. One video isn't going to take down a crew. Oftentimes you see law enforcement investigate crews for years. They look at these videos to give them clues and try to decipher what's a real threat and what's just music. But I speak to other people that work with street crews, and they say that while they understand that some of these videos can be incriminating, they don't trust that law enforcement has the sophistication to decipher what's a battle rap, someone just describing what they've seen going on in their neighborhood, and someone who's actually incriminating themselves, someone who pulled the trigger.
Is there any sure way to know? I mean, are there clues if you were smart enough to pick them up?
You know, I'm not a member of law enforcement, but they're saying that if crews are behind such a huge chunk of shootings and kids are dying, and if the writing on the wall is from social media, they have to look at that.
The NYPD looks at Twitter and Facebook to track the activity of these gangs. Does that work?
Like a lot of kids, they don't leave the house without posting it on Instagram or Facebook. If they didn't post it, it didn't happen. And what you see with rival crews is that they'll take a picture outside a rival's housing project and then post it as a taunt. We've seen cases where a kid is shot and the rival crew member will post a picture of them wearing the dead kid's jacket on Facebook. It's very hard for some of these members to resist doing these things, even though we've heard time and time again that law enforcement is monitoring social media.
You spoke in one of your pieces to David Brotherton, who is a sociologist, and he explained why.
You know, you want to be somebody. Yeah, in your daily life, you're nobody. I mean, in a sense, you're invisible, and yet, if you're in a gang, you're very visible. You know, in fact, you strike fear in the very people who want to make you invisible.
What you hear from, you know, sociologists like Brotherton and law enforcement is that the urge to be visible and to belong to something overrides other concerns. Their lives get carved up into ribbons, where they can go and where they can't go, and it makes their life incredibly small. And part of posting on social media and making these videos and being seen is trying to expand their life and their experience.
What's the conventional wisdom on why kids join gangs despite the likelihood of being killed or arrested?
Because these street crews are battling over turf, you see buildings that are separated where there'll be a crew in the front and a crew in the back. And the kids in the back can't go to the front or they're risking their life. They can't walk a straight line to school. These street crews, oftentimes, these are kids you grew up with. They live in your neighborhood. They live in your building. Sometimes you join because they have your back and it makes it all the difference if you can go to the store or not. So here's Assistant Commissioner Kevin O'Connor on the practical need to join a street crew.
I'm not telling you not to be in a crew because I don't know what the answer is to get in the front door. If that's the tool they need to get home, that's what they do. But what we do is we make them aware of the consequences of calling yourself something.
Kevin O'Connor also has talks, you know, for parents, for kids, trying to warn them about what they post and who they're friends with can have consequences, that they can get swept into an investigation if they're posting and even if they're a wannabe. You know, sometimes with these videos, kids will save up a bunch of money and they'll hire a semi-professional to film them, the actual crew members, the drug dealers, everyone will be out there. And just because some of the people in the videos happen to be involved in the crew doesn't mean that the rappers are part of the crew. But again, it's guilt by association.
I was really surprised by the production values of some of these.
And 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 hits.
Way past your block.
I know. We'd be lucky if we got those many hits. They're just talking about street life. They're talking about the hood. And they want to legitimize their hood. I post about public radio because I work for public radio. That's where I spend my time. Well, they live in public housing. They live in the hood. I mean, you just post about what you know. But sometimes what they know and what they see happen to be criminal acts.
Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brooke.
WNYC reporter Kathleen Horn.
Coming up, can you make money streaming music? Yes, you can.
All you have to do is never stop writing songs. This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The streaming music service Spotify doesn't get much love from recording artists. Last year, Radiohead's Tom York removed some of his solo music because he said Spotify hardly pays new artists. Spotify replied that although the average song generates about 0.7 cents per stream in royalties, it is possible for big artists to rack up a decent sum. But what if you're a little artist? OTM producer PJ Vogt, the co-host and producer of our new podcast and blog TLDR, found a very little artist who's found a way to actually make a living from Spotify.
20% of the songs on Spotify have never been played. That's 4 million songs that have been so thoroughly orphaned that even their creators couldn't be bothered to play through them just once. There's a good chance that at least some of these were written by a guy named Matt Farley. Matt records in his basement in Danvers, Massachusetts. For work, he does 2 long shifts at a group home every week, and that lets him spend the other 4 days just writing songs. When his wife, Elizabeth, comes home from work, she'll sometimes just stand upstairs and eavesdrop.
She likes to not tell me when she's coming home so that she can come home and hear, you know, honk, honk, honk goes the horn, beep, 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 honk your horn. And then, like, I hear footsteps. I'm like, are you home? She's like, I like your new song, and I'm totally embarrassed.
Matt's clean cut and tall. He looks like he could model an airline neck pillow in a catalog. And his house is like any suburban house you've ever seen. Until you go down into that basement, which really is like his secret laboratory, where he's inventing a million weird bands that are really just him churning out song after song after song. Since he started in 2008, he's recorded more than 14,000 songs. He can do 100 on a good day. And he's recorded 4,250 happy birthday songs alone.
Hey, Alex. Hey there.
Thanks, Alan. It's your birthday. You probably knew that, Anne. You probably knew that, Anne. Cause after all, Anne, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Guadalupe. Guadalupe, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Guadalupe.
Matt's latest album is about transportation. That's where that honk, honk, honk goes the horn, beep, beep, beep lyric comes from. This is not an album about problems with transportation or about something that happened while someone was transporting from one place to the other. It's an album about transportation, the noun. He lets me peek at his notes.
Right, so this is just, it's a notepad with every car, truck, motorcycle, tractor, trailer, camper, van, minivan, van, bicycle, tricycle, train, subway, taxi, cab.
Matt has pages and pages filled with columns of song ideas. And by ideas, I mean words.
Coming up, a little preview. Oh, the clothing album is going to be so good. Boots, shoes, sneakers, high heels. The body parts album, foot, toes, ankle, big toe, pinky toe, middle toe, Achilles tendon.
All right, so this is something you need to understand about Matt. All his life, Matt has made slightly arbitrary choices and then committed to them hard. Like in fifth grade, when his friend started swearing, he thought it'd be funnier to not swear. So he didn't, and he still won't. Or he really likes walking. So last year, he walked from his house in Danvers to the Boston Marathon, which means he basically walked the length of a marathon to just go watch a marathon. He also publishes a monthly newsletter about long walks, which is handwritten. When he does something, he does it big, including the music.
So I have a band called the Toilet Bowl Cleaners, and there's 8 albums of poop songs. You'd think I would run out, but the most recent one is like my pet sounds of poop songs. It's intense. It's beautiful.
What's it called?
It's called You Thought We Ran Out of Poop Song Ideas. You Were Wrong. Like, at first, it's just the poop song, you know, where I just sing the word poop. Poop! Poop, 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 poop. Poop, poop. And that's a little frustrating because the poop song where I sing the word poop is the number one song. All I do is sing poop, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And then there's others where I write what I consider to be good music and clever lyrics, and they do well enough, but it's like, geez. But it's getting a little more abstract. You know, Poop Into a Wormhole is one of my favorite new tracks, and it's fantastic.
When you play a song on Spotify or on iTunes, the musician gets a tiny royalty. And a lot of them are angry about how bad the pay is. Matt's not. Matt's secret is that even if none of his songs are ever hits, he can still make half a living because there's just so many of them. And a lot of them are about things that people tend to search for online. So he's got kind of a song for everybody.
Liberals love criminals, everybody knows. They love to help them get out on parole.
That's a song by Matt's band, the Ultra Right Wing Conservatives.
Big government is good. We need more programs. We need to hire more people to work for these programs.
That, of course, is the extreme left wing liberals.
Who's gonna be pitching last? The man with a great, great stash. The man they call the Axe. John Axford.
And that, of course, is from the Green Bay and Milwaukee sports band.
Facial hair, and so they're unaware of strikes arisen by them.
My standard is if a song earns me $2 in a year, then I'm doing well. There's plenty of songs that make 3 cents a year, but, you know, it all averages out, and I'm up to 14,000.
So if on average, if you have 14,000 songs, are you making like $28,000 a year on royalties?
This year was 23,000. You know, I'm hoping for 25, 26 next year, which would be nice.
That's great.
Yeah.
One of the things about staring at the internet all day is you can have this feeling of being overwhelmed by just how much, like, content there is. How much crap. How many tiny things made by people to grab your attention for 1 second that no one's ever loved or cared about. And Matt's music should be like that. He writes songs about everything that people search for to make a tiny bit of money to make a living. But for some reason, when you find one of his songs, it feels specific and tailored and made for you, even though his process really is completely impersonal.
My newest thing that I just released is an album called Songs About Things in My House. And like there's the door song, the window song, the stove, the refrigerator, and so on and so forth. And I was cracking up.
Wait, but that That feels like one that wouldn't do super well.
Yeah, but it just got out, put out a week ago in the song about my hot water heater sold. Hot water heater! Someone actually spent 99 cents on that.
A lot of the reason that Matt makes art is to connect with people. Artists say that line all the time, but with Matt, it's literal. He puts his phone number in his songs. And strangers call.
At least once a day. I gotta turn the phone off overnight, my wife insists. Because I would be so excited at 3 in the morning to get a call. Hey, are you the guy from the song? Like, yeah, I am. And I'll talk their ear off. What's funny is also, they end up ending the phone. You know, usually it's like the person is the one who's like, look, I don't have time for you, I gotta go. And in fact, it usually goes the other way. We're like, well, I guess that's all I wanna know. I gotta go now. I'm like, okay, thanks, bye.
So this is the question that everybody asked me when I told them about Matt. I felt really uncomfortable asking it, which I think you can hear in the tape.
Well, it's just, I guess, like, so when I was talking to friends about this, they'd be like, the question I asked would immediately be like, either are the songs good? Yeah. I mean, it's weird. What would you say to that?
I would say some of them are good because they're good. They're definitely catchy. Plenty of them are terrible, but the fact that they exist is wonderful. I would like it if someone else was doing what I was doing. So therefore, I'm doing it for anyone else out there like me.
When I talked to Matt, it was 2 days before Christmas, and I still hadn't bought a present for either of my step-parents. It's really hard to buy presents for your step-parents. So I asked Matt if he wouldn't mind writing songs for them. Here's what I get for Nan.
Short for Nancy?
For Diana.
Okay.
My dad's wife.
You could do Diana, too. Or you could do that either way.
Let's go with Nan. I like Nan.
She likes going to New York City, and she has a bunch of stray cats called Lolos that she feeds and the neighbors are really mad about. And she drinks white wine, and she's really thoughtful at buying people presents, which is why I've been freaking out about getting her a Christmas present.
What does she call you? Should I mention you in the
song? Yeah, yeah. She calls me PJ.
Okay. White wine, thoughtful gift giver.
Yeah, and she really loves her kids. Is that too much stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, let me just think of some chords here.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Merry Christmas, Nan. Nan who loves to go to NYC. Nan, keep on feeding those Lolos, even though the neighbors say no, no. Merry Christmas, Nan. Sitting back with a glass of white wine. Merry Christmas, Nan. You always know just what kind of gift to get for PJ, and PJ was thinking that maybe it was time you deserved a song. Merry Christmas, Nan.
I drive back to Pennsylvania for Christmas and spend 2 days just totally psyched to have this song. I play it for friends off my giant tape recorder, none of whom find it as charming as I do. It's like playing a recording of a stranger doing karaoke. But then on Christmas Day, I play it for Nan, and she grins from ear to ear. She makes me play it again and again, and she asks me to email it to her and reminds me not to forget, and then later writes me a really heartfelt email about how nice it made her feel. I know that this song is just some chords and five facts that I gave to Matt, but here's where I think its secret power comes from. Matt's songs mostly just inventory the world. Yeah, there's a door. Yep, there's a water heater. Yep, you're in the family. But when you have step-parents, saying, yeah, you're in the family, is this thing that maybe never gets said. The song uncomplicated a complicated situation by just stating facts. As a reporter, you are not supposed to do stories because you want the person you're covering to become famous. But I want Matt Farley to become famous. I want him to be able to write a song for every single noun.
You can find all the episodes of the TLDR podcast on our website at tldr.onthemedia.org.
Could I please get everybody's attention? I've discovered a wormhole to another dimension. No man alive would dare go inside. So I'm gonna squat over it and send my poop for a ride.
Poop, poop.
I'm gonna poop into a wormhole.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarab Durkman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Alana Casanova-Burgess, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.